And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. We've spent a lot of time on this show talking about the Democratic race for president, and indeed there are interesting aspects of it. In fact, I will talk about a few of them this hour. It seems to me, for example, that Hillary Clinton is going a little bit beyond the pale. I think I've defended her. Even though I endorsed Obama, I've defended her conduct at this point. Starting to leave me cold, and I'll let you know why in this hour. But I want to spend most of the time talking about the other half, the other side. I'm talking, of course, about Senator John McCain. It's fun to talk about Mike Huckabee. I mean, he certainly is an interesting character. Seems very nice until you find out he wants to quarantine all people with HIV and make sure that God's law is in the Constitution. But Senator John McCain will be the Republican nominee for president. And as everyone who hasn't been hiding under a rock knows by now, the New York Times published an article yesterday talking about John McCain's relationship with a 40-year-old lobbyist by the name of Vicky Eisman. John McCain is 71. What is that relationship? Well, it's kind of hard to tell. His staff thought it was a romantic relationship. The Times reports that and also reports the suggestion that he was giving this lobbyist all kinds of favors. Now, giving lobbyists favors in Washington is not really news. People give lobbyists favors all the time in Washington. But John McCain claims he's different. John McCain says he's not a victim of special interest, that he's not that kind of politician. Well, is he? The Times paints a pretty compelling picture of his relationships with Vicky Eisman. It's interesting that she was a lobbyist for telecommunications companies, the same companies, it seems, that I've talked so much about with regard to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the companies that the president has asked to cover up his illegal actions, and they've been all too willing to do so. I want to talk this hour about John McCain, not just about the article in the New York Times and the intrigue behind the article, which in some ways is more interesting than the article itself, but also whether the article's fair. I mean, just because he's a Republican, is it fair to report this kind of thing? Just like was it fair to report on Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky? I mean, we have to be consistent here. If it wasn't fair in the first instance, is it fair in the second instances? What are the differences between a Monica Lewinsky and a Vicky Eisman? And is it fair if a president has an affair to report on those kinds of things? I also want to talk about McCain in general, his foreign policy, what he supports, being in Iraq for 100 years. Is it true that Islamic terrorism should be the focus of the United States foreign policy for the next 100 years, or is he perhaps giving the terrorists too much credit? The fact that John McCain is not too well versed in economic policy, and whether or not the fact that he's seen as a maverick, he's seen as someone who goes to the middle, seen as someone who disagrees with Republican orthodoxy, and in some ways that's true, whether or not that will allow him to beat the Democrat in the fall. Who's the Democrat? Well, it's looking more and more likely like it's going to be Senator Barack Obama. At this point, I think it's his to lose. If Senator Obama wins Ohio and Texas on March 4th, if he wins them both, I think Hillary Clinton will be hard-pressed to continue her campaign. I mean, if she loses both of those, there's only one big state left that she could win. That's the April primary in Pennsylvania. And by that time, the momentum will be so severe, she'll be in real trouble. Now, does it mean that Barack Obama will get the 2025 delegates he needs? Maybe. He just might do it. But if he falls a few short and he's got, you know, 1950, and Hillary Clinton has, 1,500 or something like that, then I think that, first of all, John Edwards can make the difference, play kingmaker, and I think he might very well do that and throw his delegates to Obama. I also think the superdelegates will go his way. So I want to talk about McCain, talk about Obama and Clinton, and also, of course, invite all of you to join in the discussion. The toll-free number, as you know, is 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. The New York Times article as I said, the intrigue into whether or not to publish it is almost more interesting than the article itself. First of all, there's the article, and if you haven't read it, there's a link on my website. And the article goes through and explains how John McCain has this history with Vicki Eisman. And they both deny a romantic affair, but he is so has spent so much time with her 9-10 years ago on corporate jets, in his office, hanging out with her, that then, of course, he helped her clients. He wrote letters on behalf of her clients, mostly consisting of allowing telecommunications companies to merge in ways that are anti-competitive. But McCain says, you know, these are things Republicans support anyway. Republicans support consolidation of the media. They don't like a number of free and independent news sources. They say let the market do what the market does, and if you want to pay off players so that little independent media gets squelched under the big players, well, that's just the Republican way. So he was helping a lobbyist, sure, but that's no different than something he would have voted for anyway, and in some ways he says he votes against their interests. But I think what the New York Times has opened up is, one, how traditional Washington works, two, that McCain is as much a player as anybody else, and three, another compelling reason why Obama would do better than Clinton, being someone outside the system, someone who's very much arguing that special interests need to be curbed. Now, one of the reasons why this hits McCain so hard is not because I think it's worse than what other senators, Republican and Democrat, are doing in Washington, but because McCain has been trying for the last 17 years to argue he is not a campaign of the special interests. And why has he been working so hard to do that? Probably because in 1991, he was helping the most special interest of them all. I've been shocked that there's been no mention of the Keating Five by Mike Huckabee or by Mitt Romney, who was very harsh against McCain. Why didn't he mention the Keating Five? Why wasn't it mentioned by Giuliani or Thompson or, heck, even Ron Paul? How come you never hear about Charles Keating? Do you remember who Charles Keating was? In 1991, Charles Keating ran a bank in Arizona and was closely connected with John McCain's second wife. This man, this very rich real estate financier in Arizona, took a liking to John McCain, who had just come home from a excruciating experience as a POW. One of the things I do want to talk about this hour is John McCain's experience being tortured in the Hanoi Hilton and how that may be inconsistent with his torture stand today. Robert writes about it on the blog, and I think it's a very interesting discussion. We'll get to that. It's important to know who this man is, who this Republican candidate is. He is certainly more complex than a George W. Bush. It's easy to caricature George W. Bush because, heck, Bush is stupid. Bush is violent. Bush is seems to take pleasure, really, in taking over dictatorial powers and in doing so to help the richest corporations. The question is, how much would John McCain fit in that mold? Well, John McCain came back after excruciating, and let's be fair. I mean, the man served his country. He served in a war that we should never have fought, but he underwent excruciating torture and mistreatment, maltreatment at the hands of the Vietnamese. And in fact, I just recently read the article published in 1973 in U.S. News and World Report regarding his experiences there. But he came back. He was ready to be in politics. And the way it works to be in politics is you need a bunch of money. That's not the way it should work, but it's the way it works. And to get that money, he got Charles Keating to finance virtually everything. And if you have a backer, a rich and powerful backer, you're going to do well in politics. Again, it shouldn't be that way, but that is how it is. And Charles Keating almost single-handedly put John McCain in office, first as a member of the House and later as a member of the Senate. When you got a bank account like that and someone supporting you and those local ties to Arizona, John McCain wasn't from Arizona. As I said, his second wife was from there, and she is the heiress to a beer fortune. Again, that helps. And again, it's rarely discussed. I mean, for all the discussion of John Kerry's wife, remember how much people mentioned how rich she was? how little has been talked about the fact that John McCain in his second marriage also married an heiress. Why isn't that in the mainstream media discussion? Well, probably because the mainstream media slobbers over John McCain and has for practically all of his political career. So he married an heiress, as John Kerry did, as frankly George Washington did when he was looking to achieve political gains. He was a young army officer as well, married a very rich divorcee by the name of Martha Washington, used her standing to bring him into power. It seems that's the way it works in America, right? But if it was talked about with John Kerry's wife, maybe we should talk a little bit more about Cindy McCain. In any case, he goes marries Cindy McCain in Arizona. She gets him in touch with Charles Keating. Charles Keating finances all his campaigns. Then he becomes a senator, and Charles Keating needs his help. You see, Charles Keating was doing what perhaps all of us would love to do, gambling with no chance of loss and every chance of gain. You know, when I go to Las Vegas, you know, I put some money down. I certainly hope to win. But there's real fear there that I might lose. Sometimes I have to fold my hand in poker because if I'm wrong, I can lose a lot of money. Well, Charles Keating was betting with taxpayer money. He ran a savings and loan, which is guaranteed under the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. There's actually, it was FISLIC, the Federal Savings and Loans Insurance Corporation. It's the same thing as the FDIC. Basically, what they do is they say that if your bank goes and they fail, all the depositors are paid for. So what Charles Keating could do with the guaranteed money is go and do some of the riskiest investments possible in real estate and so forth. Frankly, it's very similar to what banks are doing in the subprime market today, very similar to what caused today's recession. Amazing how we never seem to learn from the past. And the problem for him was that bank regulators saw that he was doing that he was taking all kinds of risks with the bank, and knowing that if the real estate risks pay off, he gets a lot of money. If they don't, well, the taxpayers kick in. Heads, Keating wins. Tails, taxpayer lose. It's really a no loss for Charles Keating. But the regulators came in, saw that he was making a bunch of risky investments, and started to find out what he was doing. At which point, Senator McCain and four other senators, affectionately known as the Keating Five, met with the bank regulators and told them to back off. They did, and Charles Keating's bank failed 2 years later, leading to a mountain of debt, a huge taxpayer sum, and frankly, a whole savings and loans crisis in the Ronald Reagan era that some of you may be too young to remember. But it cost the taxpayers hundreds of billions of dollars, and basically generally the banks got away with it. Now, Charles Keating did go to jail, and John McCain was formally reprimanded in the Senate. Again, why didn't Mitt Romney mention this? He's formally reprimanded for his role. Now, John McCain will tell you he made a mistake. And frankly, I think he's dealt with it in the best way you can when you've gone and tried to help a big campaign contributor call off the government. I think in many ways it was worse than what George Bush did for Kenny Boy Lay, his top contributor, the owner of Enron. But you see the pattern here. Rich corporate sponsors using corporations' money and taxpayer money to make risky investments, to cheat the American people, using their money to convince politicians to call off the regulators and leaving taxpayers holding the bag. In the case of Enron, the taxpayers holding the bag, of course, you know, were the Californians who wanted to use electricity. In the case of Charles Keating, it was all of us who had to put a ton of money into saving the savings and loans crisis. And now we have a new scandal with the subprime mortgages, and you can see, in fact, that George Bush's bill, in fact, doesn't help so much the poor people who are going to lose their homes, but does help out the investors who were silly enough to invest in these loans. So John McCain has this history. It's not a very pleasant history, and it's not one that he wants to talk about very much. Understandably, he wants to talk about his honorable service in the United States military and what he did as a prisoner of war. And I want to get to that service in a little bit and compare it, for example, to John Kerry's and how he was swift-boated 4 years ago. Robert, who posts on my blog at RadioInsideScoop.com, points out the fact that when John McCain was tortured, he actually denounced America. And should that be raised as a proper political attack? I'll get to that, Robert. I do want to discuss that. But let's just focus right now on the Keating Five and the fact that virtually no American who wasn't around in the 80s and politically aware in the 80s even remembers that John McCain was part of the Keating Five. Now, this is a real-life scandal. This isn't, you know, Whitewater where nothing was proven that anyone did anything wrong. He has a reprimand from the United States Senate for his activity. He admits to lobbying bank regulators to lay off his prime contributor to office, and to doing so in a way that ended up costing the American people, when you add up Keating and the other savings and loans banks, hundreds of billions of dollars. This is no small affair. And I think what the New York Times article does, totally apart from the affair question, is remind us of Charles Keating, remind us of McCain's past, remind us that no matter how much John McCain tries to say he's not a tool of special interest, in many ways, he was the ultimate tool. And the story of Vicki Eisman reminds us that this is not just something that happened 15, 20 years ago with Keating. This is something that continues to this day, giving favors to corporate lobbyists. Remember, that's one of the main things Republicans believe in, right? With the money goes the spoils. It's all about corporations giving money to politicians and then getting billions and billions back from taxpayers. And I should say that to somewhat of a lesser extent, depending on who you talk to, the Democrats do the same thing. I don't mean to say that Democratic senators are beyond this. There are some that are. Russ Feingold, Senator Feingold of Wisconsin, has famously not taken these kind of lobbyist donations. Of course, Russ Feingold is about as pure as they get in the Senate, and he almost lost his campaign last time he ran because of it. But certainly Democrats take their share as well. Still, this article reminds us of a difference between Obama and McCain, and frankly another reason why Obama is a better choice than Hillary Clinton to run against McCain, because he's more removed from that lobbyist world. Let me go back in time to John McCain and his time serving the country, because I think that this is an issue that really Democrats should be very careful about. There should be no doubt that John McCain honorably served his country. He fought in a war that I think was a huge mistake, that he probably thinks was a good idea, and that's another problem we'll get to with his foreign policy, but still, as a young man with a long history of having family in the service, his father, his grandfather, uncles, and such. His father actually became, a lot of people don't know this, the Eastern Theater commander, and eventually the commander of all U.S. forces in a sector in Vietnam. He was a very important admiral. And when John McCain, I think John McCain Sr. was his name, when his son was captured in Vietnam, the Vietnamese tried to use John McCain, the later Senator John McCain, as a propaganda tool. And McCain, to his credit, refused, did not allow that, and underwent all kinds of torture because of it. Now, Robert, one of my listeners in Nebraska who often writes on the blog, and I'm very glad to do that. And by the way, let me encourage you. There's a great, you know, RadioInsideScoop.com has room to comment on every show, and I want to encourage you to do that. A lot of people listen to the show as an archive, and it's a way to talk with other people who listen to the show. But Robert writes in, Mark, maybe you can verify a rumor's truth. And he's not talking about Vicki Eisman. This was before Vicki Eisman. He's talking about the rumor that John McCain, as a POW, when he was tortured, actually denounced America. Well, that rumor is true. How do I know it's true? Not from unsourced claims in the New York Times. I know because John McCain has said it himself. In his own book, Faith of Our Fathers, he describes a series of tortures that were done to him back in the 1960s. Rope bindings, beatings every couple hours. He was suffering from dysentery. His teeth and bones were broken. John McCain attempted suicide, and it was stopped by the guards. After 4 days of this, this is from John McCain's book, and I got it from the Wikipedia article on him. After 4 days of this, McCain signed and taped an anti-American propaganda confession that said that he was, quote, a black criminal, unquote, and an air pirate, quote, unquote, although he used stilted communist jargon and ungrammatical language to signal that the statement was forced. He felt then and always that he had dishonored his country, his family, his comrades, and himself by his statement. But as he would later write, quote, I had learned what we all learned over there. Every man has his breaking point. I had reached mine, unquote. There were other times when he refused to give these forced confessions.
Let me be 150% clear. I don't blame John McCain a bit
for denouncing America under torture. Frankly, I think most of us, if tortured, would do the same. At the end of the day, I think most people should realize that statements made under torture are extremely likely to be false, and no one should blame us if, under torture, we say almost anything. I will not blame anyone who speaks under torture. John McCain did speak. He did denounce America. But at the same time, he didn't give them any militarily useful information, and he was very proud of that. And I praise his service. But I also look at his own response to torture and say to myself, this is proof beyond proof that torture doesn't work. This same John McCain that is proud of the fact that even though he denounced America under torture, he at the same time did so ungrammatically and in ways that let people know that he didn't mean it. At the same time, he didn't give any useful military information, although he did tell the mission he was on and the ship that he was on, and even, you know, the place they were bombing. He told all that, and that was certainly against the code of conduct, and he regretted that he said it. But he knew that this was of no military value to the North Vietnamese. Okay, John McCain, fine. But what does that mean in the context of the people we torture? What does that mean when John McCain, who sponsored a bill to prohibit torture, and then saw a George Bush signing statement that said, well, it all depends on what the definition of torture is, and I define torture as to being anything that I refuse to do, and I won't tell you what I refuse to do, so anything I do as President of the United States is not torture, ipso facto, by definition, this bill's meaningless. That was George Bush's signing statement. I made it a little more crass and clear, but that's what he said. So the Democrats had another bill that just last week proudly passed the House and the Senate that says, all right, you won't define torture, Mr. President. You won't define torture, John McCain. We will. There are 19 approved interrogation techniques. Those are fine. The others aren't. You can't do to people what was done to John McCain. No water torture, which they call waterboarding, which, as I've talked about, Americans have been court-martialed for doing more than a century ago in the Spanish-American War. 8 Japanese were executed for water torturing Americans and British in World War II. But now it's okay. And, of course, it goes beyond water torture. Some of the techniques that were used in the Spanish Inquisition, that were used by the Nazis, making people stay out in the cold, naked, for days on end, denying them food and sleep and so forth. All these things John McCain wants to leave around. And the question is why? John McCain's own experience should teach him that these things have no value. That when you torture someone, they'll say anything, but that anything is likely to be meaningless. Hasn't John McCain learned from his own experience? He knows that when he was tortured, he didn't give useful information. What makes he think that anyone else will? Does he really believe that he's so special? Maybe he does. Maybe he thinks he's stronger than everybody else, that he's stronger than any Islamic terrorist. Really? Maybe that's what he believes. Is he saying that no American ever will give information under torture? Does he really say that torture is productive? Because if he's saying that he's stronger and some Americans are weaker, isn't he encouraging torture to find out which POW is going to be strong and which one's going to be weak? Is torture productive, John McCain? Yes or no? Are you really holding the view that it is okay for us to torture and not okay for our enemies to do so? Because if that's the case, then our enemies can hold the same view. It's okay for them to torture, but not okay for us to torture. I don't think we in any way denigrate John McCain's service by noting that he really didn't succumb. And that's a good thing for John McCain, a good thing for America, and a real black mark on the idea of torture. And this flip-flop needs to be posed. And it's going to be one that the Democrats have to carefully do. The point is not that John McCain denounced America. The point is he did so under torture. The point is that torture just doesn't work. But John McCain will certainly run for election, as he's done, talking about his past experience, talking about his experience as a POW, running as a hero. That's fine. But does that mean he'd be a good president? What were the lessons that John McCain learned from Vietnam, other than to steadfast and try to resist torture? What did he learn about United States foreign policy? When we come back, I want to talk about John McCain and U.S. foreign policy, exactly what his views are in foreign policy, and also do another discussion on another aspect of the issue, and that is this New York Times article. When, if ever, is it proper for a newspaper to talk about a politician having an affair? Was it proper with Lewinsky? Is it proper with Eisman? Is it proper with Gary Hart or anybody else? Let me know your views on that. Toll-free number, 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
LOL. Well, AISI, it was NBD.
Kids are spending more and more time online, and even if you heard what they're typing, you probably wouldn't know what they're saying.
Some PPL, whatever. ISS.
They chat online in a language full of acronyms, and unless you use it every day, you won't understand it.
YIWGP.
You won't know what they're saying, or who they're saying it to. A lot of times, neither do they. Last year, one in five children was sexually solicited online. So here's an acronym for you. HDOP. Help Delete Online Predators. To protect your kids' online life and to get a full list of acronyms kids are using, call 1-800-THE-LOST or visit cybertipline.com. A message from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the Ad Council.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. I'm no fan of John McCain's, but I don't like the New York Times story about him one bit. This isn't journalism. This is tawdry sensationalism. The front page story strongly implies that McCain, 71, had a romantic relationship with lobbyist Vicky Eisman, 40, 8 or 9 years ago, and that because of that, he interceded on behalf of her clients. Problem is, both McCain and Eisman deny that they were involved, and no one else in the story confirms it. As to interceding for her clients, it turns out deep in the article that McCain actually pushed legislation that ran counter to the interests of her clients, at least some of the time. So there's not much of a lobbying scandal here either. With the imprimatur of the New York Times, the networks and the cable stations ran with the story anyway, predictably flashing the picture of the attractive blonde woman next to McCain. Is this what our journalism has turned into? The flimsiest 8-year-old innuendo becomes a sex scandal? The line between good journalism and junk journalism apparently no longer exists at the New York Times. And as John Stewart noted on Larry King, it ceased to exist a while ago, thanks to Judith Miller. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Listen, man, adding fractions is no big deal.
Nah?
No. You just got to find what they call the common denominator. Let me show you.
All right.
Now, see these bottom numbers?
Yeah.
These are the denominators. That one's a 4, and that one's an 8.
Mm-hmm.
You just double both of these numbers, so that becomes an 8, too. Then you add them up.
Man, you sure make this easy.
Charles Bennett always dreamed that after college he'd return to the old neighborhood as a teacher. But without the money for tuition, only half of his dream came true. He's back in the old neighborhood.
Well, enough math. I gotta deliver these sandwiches.
Oh, sure.
Please support the United Negro College Fund. Call 1-800-332-UNCF. A mind is a terrible thing to waste. A public service brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're talking about the almost certain to be Republican nominee, John McCain, senator from Arizona, his past, his history, his views, his lobbying efforts, and of course the recent New York Times article about him and an alleged adulterous affair with a 40-year-old lobbyist. Let me just finish, though, the issue of John McCain and war. Bob Kincaid writes in the chat room, what's honorable about dropping bombs on peasant huts? I don't think that the United States' conduct in Vietnam was honorable. I don't think it's a war we ever should have fought. But I do think the one lesson we should have learned from Vietnam is to distinguish between the president and the troops. George Bush all the time tries to conflate the president and the troops. Frankly, John McCain does the same when they pretend that if we're against U.S. foreign policy, if we're against the war in Iraq, if we're against George Bush sending 150,000 troops over there for no good reason, that we're somehow against the troops. We clearly are not. Indeed, I would argue about the best thing we can do for the troops is to bring them home. Despite the fact that John McCain, while a prisoner of war, would not meet with the people who were fighting against the Vietnam War, it is no doubt due to their efforts, and not due to John McCain, that John McCain finally escaped the hellish Hanoi Hilton. Maybe John McCain is persistent enough, stubborn enough, that he would rather be there today, 30 years later, still there, still defending a corrupt, dictatorial South Vietnamese government against another corrupt, dictatorial, communist North Vietnamese government. But it's not the fault of the troops for the policy of the president. Those policies are properly condemned to the president, not to the troops. And frankly, our troops, to the extent that they are following orders and not going beyond that, now, not torturing. There are points, of course, where Nuremberg has taught us if you're following orders, that's not good enough. The people at Abu Ghraib, I think, were following orders, and that's not good enough. I think if the United States is intentionally dropping bombs on peasant huts that are not in any way a terrorist, you know, target or a Viet Cong target, that's certainly beyond. Then I think there are times when a soldier has to refuse to follow orders. But in general, a soldier who's merely conducting a stupid war at the focus of a very dangerous and idiotic commander-in-chief, I do think we have to blame the commander-in-chief and not blame the troops. I think that's a political mistake as well as a moral one. But in any case, what does it say about John McCain's attitude toward war? That I think a question for John McCain is this. I know he condemns the fact that 10 years after the Vietnam War began, longer in fact, that in 1975, when North Vietnam broke the treaty and invaded South Vietnam, Gerald Ford said, enough was enough. Take it. Take it. It's just not worth the cost in American blood and arms. I know he strongly disagrees with that. Let's ask him that question. What should Ford have done? Should Ford have sent 50,000, 100,000 troops back to Vietnam in 1975? Should we still be fighting the war today? The irony, of course, is that after North Vietnam took over South Vietnam and did vicious things there, vicious slaughters, eventually Vietnam today is a lot better off than it was under American occupation. It's still communist, but it's getting away from some of the worst parts of communism. It is trading with the United States. It's becoming maybe not the most productive in the family of nations, but a heck of a lot better off than it was 35 years ago. I suspect the exact same thing will happen in Iraq. If and when we leave Iraq, there will be some massive bloodletting, no question about it. One of the reasons why I support an independent Kurdish state in the north is to have a place, a haven, for the Iraqis that helped Americans. I didn't support this war, but I do recognize that there were Iraqis. There are Iraqis that are helping us, and I don't want to see them massacred. That's why I support that haven in the north. But there will be bloodletting, and then eventually some kind of stability will work its way. And the question is, do we want 150,000 American troops in the middle of that? John McCain, I think, needs to be asked about how his Vietnam experience relates to the war in Iraq. Does he think we should still be fighting in Vietnam? He argues we need to be in Iraq for 100 years. Should we also be in Vietnam for 100 years? Why or why not? Discuss. The media never asks John McCain these tough questions, and yet they are something that he should have a ready answer for, right? I mean, when you spend 6.5 years pretty much by yourself being tortured thousands of miles away from America, you should have an answer to that question. I suspect John McCain wanted to continue the war in Vietnam for the same reason any of us that are beaten down want to continue. In order to live, he had to fight against the ideas that he was being tortured to believe, and so he stuck to them even more firmly. And even though the war was a stupid, idiotic thing, for him to reject it and be against the war would be, in his view, to give in to his captors. Interestingly, torture actually made John McCain less likely to cooperate with his captors rather than more likely, which again is another argument against torture. But what it does is it makes John McCain extremely persistent. In other words, it doesn't matter whether we have any strategic interest in Vietnam. It doesn't matter whether we have any strategic interest in Iraq. It's better just to spend billions and trillions of dollars and thousands and tens of thousands of lives. Better that than to not lose. We all know men like that. Maybe a few women, too. I think there are more men. They get so persistent, that want to play a game to win so badly, that they lose sight of the fact that it's only a game. Hey, I recognize that in myself sometimes. I'm a pretty competitive guy. I don't know if you've ever played a game with me, but hey, I want to win. But hopefully I don't want to win so badly that I lose sight of the larger picture, that I lose sight of the relationship perhaps I have with the person I'm playing a game with. It's fun to be competitive. And it's great to win wars. And it's great to have the troops come home to a brass band. But how many trillions of dollars is that worth? How many tens of thousands of lives is that worth? And what do we gain? What do we gain? What could we possibly gain in Iraq? What could we gain if we stayed in Vietnam? And do those interests, you know, helping our oil companies and things like that, how does that measure against the cost in dollars and in blood? John McCain needs to be confronted with this fact. It may well be only because he was tortured that he has this persistence of insisting on winning even to the extent that we lose everything else that matters in America, whether it's economy, whether it's the way we're perceived around the world. John McCain wants to win at all costs. But is that a good thing? Is it good to want to win at all costs? Does it matter who the enemy is? Whether or not we're fighting an enemy implacable and, you know, insistent on world domination, like the Nazis say, or simply an enemy that, is not a very good country. What is the danger of Islamic terrorism? It's not so much that it isn't a danger. I don't think anyone can deny that it isn't a danger. George Bush makes us want to think that Democrats don't recognize the danger. Of course we do. But there's smart ways to fight, and there are stupid ways to fight. The irony is that the Republicans praise Ronald Reagan, who had a smart way, in some instances, of fighting the Cold War. Now, many things Reagan did were very bad to our economy. But the idea that you don't invade Moscow, you don't invade St. Petersburg, you pull up tightly around it until it implodes. That's the same strategy we had in Iraq prior to the invasion. I supported sanctions against Saddam Hussein, and the regime was imploding. Vietnam showed the opposite, right? Instead of confronting the communists by drawing up around their borders and keeping them from invading other countries, right? We went in there and supported a regime that wasn't a democracy and that frankly didn't really want our support very much. There are smart ways to fight wars and stupid ways to fight wars. And one of the people I think who knows how to fight wars, at least from his rhetoric, is Senator Barack Obama. He was condemned recently for saying that if he had actionable intelligence in Pakistan of an Al-Qaeda threat, he would go in there and he wouldn't necessarily seek Pakistani permission. John McCain attacked him as showing, well, you're such a novice. You're such a novice to do that. And then what happened just this week? What happened is we captured some Al-Qaeda leaders. How did we do it? We did it by going after them in Pakistan without informing the Pakistani government. Sounds like George Bush is listening to Barack Obama and taking some cues from him. And I got to give credit, and I rarely give credit to W. Got to give credit at least to the generals for recognizing that Obama had it exactly right. I also think Obama knows how to deal with John McCain in saying that he honors his service, but recognizing that John McCain's solutions are not the right solution. Let's be careful and cross that line appropriately. One of the reasons why many people are using the term Swift Boat to describe the New York Times article's attack is because of the Swift Boat attack on John Kerry. All of us know John Kerry had won a number of medals, the highest medals, Iron Crosses and Purple Hearts and such, and was attacked for the very thing he's most honored for his military service, and unfairly attacked and wrongly attacked. And that's the swift boating that has become a verb that's being used with regard to the Vicky Eisman article. I'll get to that in a minute. But let's be careful that we don't swift boat John McCain the way they did John Kerry, in the sense of, you know, saying he denounced America when he was tortured or things like that that Robert suggests. We have to be careful not to do that. It was wrong to do it to John Kerry. It's wrong to do it to John McCain. But what about the Eisman article? Is that a fair article? Even Matt Rothschild in the Progressive Minute doesn't seem to think it's proper or fair. And I don't know whether it is or it isn't. I don't think the focus on Lewinsky was fair. So I guess to be consistent, I don't think this is fair. And yet, it's hard, right? If we're going to play clean politics as Democrats while they're hitting us below the belt, should we have to be consistent? Maybe you can help me on that. Call in and let me know what you think. It's hard because part of me says, you know what? Man's committing adultery. That's just not our right to know. It's not our responsibility. If I have an employee and he's cheating on his wife or she's cheating on her husband, and that employee is a good employee, then I don't think I should be able to fire him or her merely because he or she is cheating on his or her spouse, right? So why should it make a difference in a president? It's certainly tawdry. It's not something that, you know, it's good for late-night comics. But I've always wondered about that. Now, I have friends that strongly disagree. I have friends, some of whom are thinking about voting for McCain, who will tell you how disgusting it was what Bill Clinton did with Monica Lewinsky. And yet Monica Lewinsky, though being a young woman, not a girl, but a young woman, at least wasn't trying to get anything from Bill Clinton other than her sexual thrill of being with a powerful man. Vicky Eisman, if this affair is true, and it may not be, but if this affair is true, was trying to get something from John McCain. She was trying to get a vote, you know, what he did for Keating, the same to do for her, to help her clients get consolidation of the media. I mean, there was a complex battle here. I don't need to go into all the details of Paxson Communications, Ion Media Networks. They were lobbying to have Pittsburgh channels, and he supported it. Now, if he did it because he was sleeping with her, that, I think, is the story. But I don't know that it's been proven. It's very interesting, the trajectory of this story. It was first reported, the New York Times has been looking at it in it for several months. And it's a real question of why they reported it now. Matt Drudge reported in December that the New York Times was looking into this story. And then the New Republic was about to report, it seems, that the New York Times was shelving the story, and then they went ahead and reported it. But what does all this mean? What if they had reported it back in November and December, back when they first had the story? If they reported it then, just before Iowa or just after Iowa and before New Hampshire, it could have damaged John McCain's chances in New Hampshire. Remember, John McCain barely beat out Mitt Romney in New Hampshire by just a couple of percentage points. If this story had come out at the time they were working on it, and he'd lost to Mitt Romney, we might have Mitt Romney as a nominee now. And yet, the New York Times endorsed John McCain. And now that this article is coming out, it's coming out at the time when it will do the least damage to John McCain. So perhaps this article should be condemned. In fact, I'd like to hear from you if you'll call and let me know whether or not you think this article is fair or not. Matt Rothschild doesn't think it's fair. Perhaps this article should be condemned, but have you noted it comes out at the best possible time for John McCain? At a time just after he's won all the delegates he needs to be nominee, but right before he wins that last delegate, so it doesn't look like it's favoritism. It's not being done right before the November elections. It's not being done right before the New Hampshire primaries. It's being done, in fact, so far away from the general election that hopefully people will forget it by then. The reporters were ready in November and December. They were ready. It was the editor, Bill Keller, the editor who shelved the story, the editor who kept it around for several months, perhaps the same editor that denied printing the warrantless wiretapping of hundreds of millions of Americans until a year after the event, the same editor that allowed Judith Miller to have such a cozy relationship with the administration, printing things that we now know were absolutely false, and doing so in ways that helped the Bush administration. The irony is that the New York Times is very, very helpful, I would argue, to John McCain through this article in lots of ways. First of all, the timing, as I said, could not be more helpful. Had it been 3 months ago or 8 months later, it would do much more dramatic harm to John McCain. Number two, by attacking John McCain and being seen as the liberal media, which is what everyone accuses the New York Times of being, then it actually rallies people to his side. Rush Limbaugh can now defend John McCain again, and they can all get happy attacking the New York Times. The irony is, if the New York Times really were a liberal newspaper, if it really were acting like the Fox propaganda channel would on behalf of conservatives, it would have printed this thing when it was ready to go, 3 months ago. So maybe they shouldn't have printed it at all. Maybe they should have printed it when it was ready 3 months ago or not printed it at all. I don't know. I don't know the details. I don't know Vicky Eisenman. I don't know what's going to come out. I do agree with Matt Rothschild. It's troubling. And I do agree that the timing of it all is troubling. And another thing that troubles me, I mentioned at the outset of the program, is Hillary Clinton. Now, y'all have heard me defend Hillary a lot. Even though I endorse Barack Obama, I have frequently said that I think she would be a fine candidate, a fine nominee, that I will happily vote for her in the fall. If she is the nominee, I will certainly still vote for Hillary Clinton in the fall. And I also think it's fair to attack, for Clinton to attack Obama and Obama to attack Clinton. After all, that's what a nomination battle is about. But I do think Clinton crossed the line when she said recently that Barack Obama is not ready to be president. Now, it's a subtle difference, but I think it's perfectly fair and just and good politics for Hillary Clinton to say, I am more ready than Barack Obama to be president. To say, I am more ready on day one than he is. And that's basically what she's been saying the entire campaign. It wasn't getting her anywhere, but she has the right to say it. But she went one tiny step further, and in going that tiny step, lost a lot of my respect. She said Barack Obama is not ready to be president. That's a line she's going to have to eat. If, as I suspect, Barack Obama is the Democratic nominee in the fall, the first thing reporters are going to do, the first thing John McCain is going to do, is to mention Hillary Clinton's line that he's not ready. It's a very different line from he's not as ready as I am, or I'm more ready. To say he is not ready is to say he's not qualified to be president of the United States. Would she say that about John McCain? I think not. One of the things I've always been concerned about, and frankly I was concerned about when people were attacking Hillary Clinton, and I was afraid that she might be the nominee, and I wanted everyone to rally around her if she were, I didn't want the attacks to go too far. In this case, I think her attack has gone too far. And I think she needs to step back from that brink. I know she very badly wants to win in Ohio and Texas, but that's one step too far gone. And I just had to say that. I don't approve of her saying that. Another step too far, and this one I think was more inexperience than anything intentional, was what Michelle Obama said last week. Many of you have heard Michelle Obama was talking excitedly about all the tens of thousands of people, millions of voters, and I guess it's now hundreds of thousands at least of people all around the country who've shown such support for Barack Obama's campaign. And she said that never in her adult life has she been proud of America until now. Now, all she had to do was change that statement slightly. What she should have said is, never in my life have I been so proud of America. That's okay. That's not even, you know, no one even would have remarked on that. And that may be well what she meant. That's not what she said. What she said was, never in my adult life have I been proud of America until now. Again, a slight difference, like Hillary Clinton's slight difference, but one in the wrong direction. Now all these people come out of the woodworks and say liberals hate America, and this just shows that Michelle Obama obviously is not proud of her country, and she's never been proud of her country until now, which shows that, well, that, you know, liberals hate America, and Michelle Obama really doesn't like America. And look, we all recognize that America has problems, and America has good things, and we all strive to make it better. None of us believe or should believe America is perfect, and none of us believe or should believe that America is all evil. America is a combination of all kinds of things. I think she should have simply said, and she hasn't come out of this very well, my friends, and part of it, again, is due to her inexperience and not being on the national stage very long. She should have said, oh, I didn't mean to say that in my adult life I haven't been proud of America until now. I meant to say that in my adult life I've never been so proud of America as I am today. I just stepped over the words, and I'm sorry. You know, kind of like when John Kerry made a foolish statement about, if you don't get a good education, you'll end up being in the military. Maybe true, but not a very smart thing to say. Michelle Obama said the wrong thing, and they need to fix that. But I think part of this shows in campaigns how easy it is to slip. The tiniest little slip can cause you a lot of trouble. Now, maybe, you know, I'd be charitable to Michelle Obama. I think it was a slip on her part when, you know, Hillary Clinton saying he's not ready to be president does sound like more of a intentional thing. But it just shows, I think, how hard it is to do this. Now, I'm reading what Mark, insert the word really, and you've got the actual quote Bob Kincaid says. So she said, I've never really been proud of America. Bob, chip in, and I want to get it right before I leave the air. What was the exact quote? I can look it up.
Mark, it's never have I been really as proud, or the word really is in there, And it's okay. A very important modifier. And what you have is a case where Fox News, once again, did a chop job on it. In one instance, cutting out really rather heavy-handedly, where you could still hear part of the edit. And then when Alan Colmes ran it, it was cleanly cut out. Now,
interesting, because Alan Colmes, I think, has always been a shill. So let's see if I can get the exact quote here. I'm looking online because I want to be fair to her. And honestly, I don't think that's what she meant in any case.
But then, Mark...
The first time she's been really proud of America. Yes, here it is right here. The first time she's been really proud of America in her adult life. But again, it's not the way I would have phrased it. I think that's fair. She should have said, "I've never been so proud as I've been today," or something like that.
But really, the follow-up to that, Mark, if I may, just real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
The follow-up, and what is much more important, I think, is the response. A, Fox had to dummy up the quote to make it worse than it was to begin with, even if, you know, okay, so we wouldn't say it that way.
Right.
But Fox had to dummy it up, and then Bill O'Reilly says that he'd be interested in lynching her if it turns out to be true.
In lynching her?
Yes, Mark.
What did he say exactly?
okay, I got it right here if you want to hear it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Let me see if I can get it to roll. Yeah, here we go. It'll take just a sec. We've got a minute or so. I don't want to go on a lynching party against Michelle Obama unless there's evidence. Now, talk about words meaning thing.
Oh, my God.
Here you go.
Marianne, Woodbury, Connecticut. What say you, Marianne?
Let me just run forward here to it.
Here
I am.
For you to say, my friend said X and Y, because fair and balanced and methodical way.
You'll get
that's
it now.
How we're going to cover this campaign. All of them. All of them. So stay on the line. Give us your information. If indeed Michelle Obama is angry about something, if she has a history, we would like to know that. And then we can put it into some kind of context so that we can be fair to everybody. You know, I have a lot of sympathy for Michelle Obama, for Bill Clinton, for all of these people. Bill Clinton. I have sympathy for them because they're thrown into a hopper where everybody is waiting for them to make a mistake so that they can just go and bludgeon them. And, you know, Bill Clinton and I don't agree on a lot of things, and I think I've made that clear over the years, but he's trying to stick up for his wife. And every time the guy turns around, there's another demagogue or another ideologue in his face trying to humiliate him because they're rooting for Obama. That's wrong. And I don't want to go on a lynching party against Michelle Obama unless there's evidence, hard facts, that say this is how the woman really feels.
There you go.
Oh, God, a lynching party. Of all words to use.
Unless.
And I love the way he says he's sympathetic to Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
You're right. Talk about faint praise. He's sympathetic because he's defending his wife. Because that's O'Reilly family value.
Yeah, because people demagogue the issues. God knows O'Reilly never demagogued Bill Clinton.
Hey, I found the Associated Press to give the quote of Michelle Obama. And here's what it says that she told an audience in Milwaukee. Quote, "For the first time in my adult life, I am really proud of my country. Not just because Barack is doing well, but I think people are hungry for change."
Yeah.
It's not the best quote. Not the best quote. What she should have said.
It ain't Churchill, okay?
No. It's a bad way to phrase it. And I think she should have said is I tripped up in what I was saying. What I meant.